too. Except they figured out how to bypass a lifetime of meditation and preserved it in the Eleusinian Mysteries. What Cicero called, quote, the most exceptional and divine thing Athens ever produced, and what Praetextatu said was crucial to the future of our species. Eleusis held, quote, the entire human race together. Without it, life would be unlivable. Dionysus would eventually make his epiphany in Demeter's temple as the holy child of Persephone, but it wasn't enough for his fanatics. They wanted him all the time. And so, for those who did not want to spend their time and money on the long initiation into the Eleusinian Mysteries, secret networks started popping up all over the Greek countryside, where the wine god and his immortality potion suddenly became much more accessible. The English classicist and theologian A.D. Nock, Harvard's leading authority on ancient religion in the mid-20th century, summed it up best in his influential article from 1952, Hellenistic Mysteries and Christian Sacraments. Nock understood the real draw of the god of ecstasy. In spite of early institutionalization, his worship retained or could recapture an element of choice, movement, and individual enthusiasm. Apart from the devotion of the sick to Asclepius, Dionysus provided the single strongest focus for private spontaneous pagan piety using ceremonial forms. Dionysiac initiations did not only, like those of Eleusis and Samothrace, confer a new status on the initiate, they also admitted him to groups of like-minded persons, possessed of the same status and often a similar hope for the hereafter, not exactly to a church, but to congregations which used the same symbols and spoke the same language. Nock acknowledges Euripides' The Bacchae as our main classical source for the mysteries of Dionysus. Its rich, descriptive vocabulary offers unique access to the nocturnal congregations of God-filled spiritual seekers. In the Dionysian Gospel, published in 2017, Dennis MacDonald of the Claremont School of Theology compares the ancient Greek of the Bacchae with the ancient Greek of the Gospel of John to prove that the evangelist was intimately familiar with these Dionysian symbols and language. In order to portray Jesus as the consummate Son of God, John knew all the loaded terms that would appeal to any Greek speaker of the time, and he used them throughout his gospel to depict Jesus as the second coming of Dionysus. The divine birth is just one example among many. As mentioned earlier, Dionysus refers to himself as the, quote, Son of God in the very first line of the Bacchae, using a phrase that is repeated later in the play. But there are many ways to communicate that in Greek. In three different places, Euripides uses the unique word gonos, which literally means begotten, alluding to Dionysus's emergence from Zeus's thigh after the death of his virgin mother, Semele. In the very first chapter of John, the evangelist uses the similar-sounding word genos, not once, but twice. He is the only gospel writer who describes the nativity of Jesus this way. When John includes the Greek phrase, monogenes theos, in chapter 1, verse 18, he means the only begotten or unique offspring of God. But in case it weren't obvious enough, John then goes on to say that Jesus is so close to God the Father, he resides in God's, quote, lap. The Greek kolpon, the region of the body extending from the breast to the legs, especially when a person is in a seated position, could not be clearer. For a Greek speaker of the time, an immediate connection to Dionysus's one-of-a-kind birth from Zeus is almost guaranteed. The only thing that is unclear about this passage is the English translation, which ignores the word kolpon entirely, putting Jesus, quote, in closest relationship with the Father. Without the ancient Greek, the explicit reference to Dionysus has been entirely lost, and today, all we're left with are weird stories about humans mating with gods. In one of the most frequently depicted scenes in Christian art, the Annunciation tells of an immaculate young girl who conceives the Son of God following unusual relations with a bird. Instead of Zeus's eagle, God the Father manifests himself as a dove, the Holy Spirit sailing on golden rays of light to impregnate the Virgin Mary. In the Dionysian Gospel, Dennis MacDonald goes on to examine all the key symbols and language from John's Gospel that have been lost in translation. But the scholar pays special attention to the one thing that really defined the God of ecstasy in the centuries before Jesus, his sacrament. Without the wine, there is no Dionysus. And without the Eucharist, there is no Christianity. The potion that would become the calling card of the new church begins right here, on Veronese's 16th century version of the water-to-wine miracle at Cana. This is how Dionysius enters Christianity, and this is how the ancient Greek pharmakon is transformed into the pharmakon Athanasias, the drug of immortality. It all started with this very scene from the Gospel of John. Here in the Louvre, across from the Mona Lisa sucking up all the air in the room, this is ground zero for the pagan continuity hypothesis. It places the Greek mysteries at the very foundation of Christianity. John's is the only gospel that records this event, the first miracle that launches Jesus' public mission. In Matthew, Jesus starts his career by healing a leper. In Mark and Luke, it's an exorcism. From the very beginning, however, John wanted his Greek-speaking audience to immediately associate Jesus with the God of ecstasy. As MacDonald states, quote, "The changing of water into wine was Dionysius's signature miracle." He goes on to quote the German scholar, Michael Laban, "The supernatural, miraculous transformation denotes the epiphany of Jesus according to the pattern of Dionysius. The juxtaposition of Jesus and Dionysius depicts Jesus as a god." Just as the Greek speakers of the time could hardly hear about the only begotten Son of God in the lap of the Father and not think of Dionysius, so they could hardly hear about Jesus' first miracle and not think of the annual miracles from the Greek district of Elis and the island of Andros. Whenever wine appears out of nowhere on the Epiphany, only one god comes to mind. As far as we can tell, John didn't want to leave any room for misinterpretation. The Greek word he uses for those enormous stone water jars is a very specific one, hudria. We know from the material evidence that there was a bustling industry producing these soft limestone vessels. At the time, their manufacture was centered in Jerusalem, where they were used for ritual purification. Each hudria that Jesus ordered filled with water could have held 20 to 30 gallons. It may not be the river of wine that the Andrians drank from every year, but that's still a pretty obscene amount of alcohol to take down in one night. As much as 180 gallons, or 1,000 bottles. Talk about the God's gift day. And because the wedding in Cana was set to take place in January, on the same day as the Epiphany miracle on Andros, and around the same time as the Lanaia ritual that launched the festival season of Dionysus, John's Greek speakers may have wondered what was happening behind the scenes. Like the Maenads on G408 and G409, could the latest wine god have added something to the wine to make it a little more miraculous? What kind of wine was this? I'm not the first to question the true nature of that evening's concoction. Aside from the Gospel of John, art historian Philip Fell identified an alternative source for Veronese's banquet scene, Pietro Aretino's Humanity of Christ, published in Venice in 1535. Aretino dramatically captures the chief steward's physical reaction to the first sample of Christianity's magical new elixir. As he smelled the bouquet of wine, which was made from grapes gathered in the vineyards of heaven, he was revived like a man who awakens from a faint when his wrists are bathed in vinegar. Tasting the wine, he felt the trickle of its sharp sweetness down to his very toes. In filling a glass of crystal, one could have sworn it was bubbling with distilled rubies. In the ancient Greek tradition, the vineyards of heaven could be traced back to the miraculous wine from Elis and Andros. Every year, they had the honor of churning out the Dionysian sacrament. What was it about the wine in Cana that inspired John the Evangelist to pen his legend, pasting Dionysus onto the first page of the Christian origin story for all time? As it turns out, John's choice wasn't so arbitrary. Jesus' coming out party in Cana was perfectly positioned, and perfectly timed to pick up where Dionysus left off. Typing Cana into Google Maps won't get you very far, but the coordinates of the biblical town might well lead to the Christian pilgrimage site of Kafir Kana in Galilee. Throughout the Hellenistic period leading up to the birth of Jesus, the whole region in the north of modern-day Israel remained, quote, an important commercial center for the production and marketing of wine. Wine that would nicely serve the Maenads in the area, whom the god of ecstasy had already converted long before Mary's son came on the scene. On that drunken epiphany in Cana, around AD 30, the new wine god wasn't playing to a random crowd. Jesus' long-awaited appearance, Epiphaneia, in Galilee, came with home field advantage. Only slightly to the south and east, the ancient city of Scythopolis was the legendary birthplace of Dionysus himself. For that reason, it was also called Nysa, providing a coherent solution for the unknown etymology of the wine god's name. The god, Dio, from Nysa, Nisus. During Jesus' lifetime, Scythopolis, Nysa, was the largest of the urban centers that formed the so-called Decapolis, Greek for 10 cities, on the eastern frontier of the Roman Empire. The god of ecstasy remained the city's patron deity, appearing all over its statues, altars, inscriptions, and coins. Today, the place is called Beth She'an, lying just west of the Jordan River. Door to door from Jesus' hometown of Nazareth, that's about 40 minutes. Like Jesus, Dionysus liked to roam these parts, and he left his mark. The appropriately titled Mona Lisa of Galilee can be found in the Greek-speaking capital of Sepphoris, modern-day Tsipori, a mere 20 minutes from Nazareth. The spectacular 54-square-foot mosaic shows a woman with the same hypnotic sideways glance as the Mona Lisa at my back. In one of 11 surviving scenes on the floor of the banquet room, she adorns a 2nd century AD Roman mansion known as the Dionysus House. The other mosaics are vignettes from the life and cults of the god of ecstasy. Several deal with ritual inebriation, including a drinking contest between Dionysus and Heracles, where the Greek word for drunkenness, or methe, appears. When these explicitly pagan images surfaced for the first time in 1987, Eric Myers of Duke University shared the consensus of the archaeological community. Their surprise discovery in a Jewish town, squarely in Jesus territory, quote, certainly blew most everyone's mind. The pagan and Judeo-Christian worlds weren't supposed to intersect, especially in a post-Jesus Galilee. But the evidence was mounting that Dionysus and Jesus could very much coexist. Years later, minds would continue to be blown as another team sifted through the dirt on the other side of the Dead Sea, due south in modern-day Jordan. In 2005, the remains of an elaborate hall were unearthed in Beida, just a couple miles north of the Petra archaeological site, the famed cosmopolitan capital of the Nabataean kingdom that stretched into the Arabian Peninsula during the Roman Empire. The colonnaded structure, complete with a courtyard, was dated to the reign of Malikos I, a mere 3 decades before the birth of Jesus. The Greek influence over the shrine that survived into the 1st century AD is overpowering. The architecture and sculpture demonstrate how well the Nabataeans had absorbed Hellenistic motifs and blended them with Nabataean traditions, including the tradition of ritual dining. The presence of the Dionysian cosmos, including images of grapes and vines, led the team from the American Center of Oriental Research in Amman to envision a unique role for this sanctuary in the, quote, transformational process that culminates in communion with the god. Beda's rural landscape overlooking extensive vineyards would have made an ideal cult center for the Nabataean royal family, who could seek a, quote, transcendent experience with Dionysus as their role model and putative ancestor. Cut from Phrygian marble sometime in the late 2nd century AD, Akanthros was discovered in the nearby Petra church, the same kind of vessel recovered by Enrique de Pons from the domestic chapel at Mas Castellar de Pontos in Spain. Contemporaneous with Jesus, the Beda complex confirms the abundantly attested presence of Dionysus in the founder of Christianity's backyard. The elder wine god could be spotted all across the southern Levant, from the Nabatean stronghold in Petra, up through the Hellenized quarters of Scythopolis and Sepphoris in Galilee. The god of ecstasy would never stray far from his sacrament, after all. In the first century AD, the area that is now Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, and Jordan made a perfectly logical home for Dionysus, who usually hails from North Africa or the Near East in the many versions of his myth. The likely reason? This is where the Canaanite and Phoenician sailors kicked off the Mediterranean wine trade in the 2 millennia before Jesus. If we target points farther east, it's also where the first signs of the cultivated grape were detected by Patrick McGovern, the Indiana Jones of extreme beverages from the University of Pennsylvania. Several sites in the area between the Taurus Mountains in eastern Turkey and the Zagros Mountains in northwestern Iran have yielded grape seeds of the domesticated variety, Vitis vinifera. According to biblical tradition, interestingly enough, this is also the same terrain that inspired Noah to plant the first vineyard on Mount Ararat, where eastern Turkey now meets Armenia, the country that boasts the earliest winemaking facility in the world at Areni, dating to about 4000 BC. From the very beginning, however, this cradle of viticulture is stocking the Mediterranean with something more than the ordinary stuff. I scrutinize all the wine in Veronese's soaring canvas, sloshing into the golden amphora, twinkling in the groom's chalice. Even the Virgin Mary cups an empty hand on the table, eager for her first taste. What was this long-haired wizard about to unleash on these people? By making Jesus' first miracle a wine miracle, the Gospel of John undoubtedly tried to establish Jesus as the new Dionysus, turning Cana into the new Elis or Andros, the place where miracles happen. But by setting his scene in the wine country of Galilee, John wasn't actually saying anything new at all. He was merely offering a reminder about the history of wine in a region that was already intimately familiar with Dionysus and his extraordinary sacrament. Before, during, and after the life of Jesus in Nazareth, the god of ecstasy enjoyed a loyal following in the neighborhood. The archaeological finds from Scythopolis to Sepphoris to Petra are clear about that. But precisely how long before Jesus did the wine get there? And what kind of wine was it? John's audience would have understood that the wedding at Cana wasn't just a party trick, and that the wine wasn't just party wine. It was a liquid pharmakon with a rich heritage behind it. The use of drugged wine didn't just accidentally creep its way into Galilee in the first century AD. A couple of thousand years before the Greeks, and long before Jesus and the Gospel of John, the sacrament that would turn Eastern Mediterraneans from beer drinkers into wine drinkers didn't just make a passing visit to the vineyards of Galilee. It started there and stayed there. Chapter 10. Holy Elixirs in the Holy Land. The wine formulas of Dioscorides from the first century AD are compelling proof of a psychedelic tradition in the Greek world. But like the spiked beer of prehistoric Europe, the physical evidence can often be elusive. At the moment, no sites in Greece have yielded any hard data for the drug of immortality. For the archaic origins of spiked wine, we have to look to the Near East, the place where it all began. In the distant past, far earlier than anyone else, the Canaanites and Phoenicians who occupied the Holy Land were ritually mixing psychoactive material into their wine. When the Greeks took control of the area in the centuries before Jesus, the old tradition was still alive. Thanks to freshly unearthed vessels and archaeochemical analyses, we now know for a fact that if ancient Galilee was good for anything, it was the kind of wine that would make Dioscorides proud. In recent years, the emerging discipline of archaeochemistry has not only rewritten the history of ancient beer, it has also rewritten the history of ancient wine. Like the nightshade beers from Spain, and perhaps even the prehistoric graveyard beers from the Rockefeller Cave and Göbekli Tepe, The wine of yesterday has emerged as a far more complex and mysterious beverage than previously thought. Once again, the star of the show is Patrick McGovern. In 2017, as mentioned earlier, he was the one who found the oldest Eurasian evidence for grape fermentation, dated to about 6,000 BC in what is now modern-day Georgia. But his scientific love affair with Stone Age wine started a couple decades earlier. In 1996, McGovern's analysis of two ceramic vessels from the Hagi Firuz Tepe site, circa 5400 to 5000 BC, in far west Iran, near the border with Turkey and Iraq, proved that Neolithic wine was resinated with terebinth, or pine resin, quote, added as a preservative and medical agent. In its archaic form, wine was not the polished, moderately psychoactive product coming out of today's vineyards. McGovern says the wine enthusiasm that consolidated in this area of the Fertile Crescent, quote, might be better dubbed a mixed fermented beverage or extreme beverage culture, making use of a wide assortment of fruits, grains, honey, and plant additives to their grape juice. Pertinent to our investigation is what McGovern calls, quote, special brews with a ritualistic purpose, perhaps laced with a flavorful or mind-altering herb. Exactly what you'd need to navigate that mysterious barrier between life and death on your journey to the imperishable stars. In Ancient Egyptian Herbal Wines, published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in May 2009, McGovern details his analysis of the tomb treasure from Abydos, belonging to the proto-dynastic ruler Scorpion I. It was unearthed in 1988 by the Cairo branch of the German Archaeological Institute and dated to 3150 BC, at the very beginning of the pharaonic line that would govern the Egyptian kingdom for the next 3,000 years. Some 700 pottery jars of a foreign type were found perfectly intact, amounting to about 1,200 gallons of a royal potion. After isolating tartaric acid, the key biomarker for wine and grape products, McGovern decided to search the yellowish, flaky residue within the jars for any herbal additives. His high-tech analysis, using solid phase microextraction, SPME, and gas chromatography mass spectrometry, GCMS, revealed a series of complex monoterpenes that naturally occur in a number of different plants and herbs. Among other chemical compounds, camphor, borneol, carvone, and thymol were extracted from the ancient residue. They are all found in yarrow, achillea, which McGovern has elsewhere described as, quote, highly suggestive of a ritual involving psychoactive plants. Using these biomolecular fingerprints, McGovern was able to pinpoint the ancient geographic source of the additives to this special brew. Nearly all were domesticated or cultivated in the southern Levant in advance of their introduction into Egypt, beginning circa 3000 BC, as the domesticated grapevine was transplanted to the Nile Delta. One may reasonably hypothesize that some southern Levantine herbs accompanied or soon followed it into the gardens and fields of the country. These developments considerably expanded the Egyptian pharmacopoeia. As for the 700 jars themselves, McGovern's analysis of 35 chemical elements concluded to a 99% probability that the jars were, quote, made of the same clays as those found in the Jordan Valley, the hill country of the West Bank, and Transjordan, and the Gaza region. In other words, they originated in the territory that would later belong to Dionysus and Jesus in the first century AD. Why did Scorpion I stockpile so much foreign wine onto his deathbed? McGovern calls it, quote, elite emulation or conspicuous consumption. Like importing liquid gold, these wine-based elixirs from the southern Levant were regularly exchanged between Near Eastern kings as gifts to seal treaties, or to simply create goodwill and lend prestige to their rule. In addition, McGovern supports Ruck's basic notion that ancient wine and other alcoholic beverages are known to be an excellent means to dissolve and administer herbal concoctions externally and internally. Before the easy availability of modern synthetic medicines, McGovern says alcoholic beverages were the universal palliative. Because the divine intoxicant was meant to accompany the Egyptian pharaoh into the underworld, however, its use as an advanced religious biotechnology cannot be overlooked. Just like the beer from Mas Castellar de Pontos, the special brew may have fueled the visionary states that allowed Scorpion I and later Egyptian kings to both witness and become one with the gods. Although priestesses are thought to have been the original enologists, and lore surrounding the vine personified it as a female entity, Osiris likely predated Dionysus as the first male wine god. According to the oldest surviving illustrated papyrus roll, which preserves the ancient Egyptian coronation ceremony in amazing detail, wine would be presented as an eye of Horus in order to cure the king of his, quote, spiritual blindness. A ritual meal was then ingested as part of the secret rites engineered to transform Osiris's earthly representative into the wine god himself. In this supreme act of mystical conjunction, drinking the god to become the god, the human king sought to merge with Osiris as the lord of death. In preparation for his eternal sleep, the royal initiate is said to have traveled to and actually experienced the cosmic underworld, receiving, quote, the awesome knowledge of what lies beyond the threshold of death. Thousands of years before Jesus or the lamas interviewed by Father Francis, the Egyptian pharaohs are said to have acquired the light body of a shining spirit, Akh in Egyptian, that allowed them to traverse the starry afterlife. Did psychedelic wine, first imported from the southern Levant, really provide the means, motive, and opportunity for this 3,000-year-long religious enterprise? According to the late archaeologist and anthropologist Dr. Andrew Sherritt, the vast quantities of wine consumed in week-long Dionysian festivals at the Temple of Karnak seemed worthy of a closer look. He noticed the same blue water lilies, Nymphaea caruleia, depicted on Karnak's pillars were also found as a garland around the golden neck of Tutankhamun when the pharaoh's tomb was first opened in 1922. Another incarnation of Osiris, the blue water lily is now extremely rare in the wild, but once grew abundantly on the shallow banks of the Nile. It was considered ancient Egypt's most sacred plant. And with the active compounds apomorphine and luciferin, it was full of psychoactive possibility. As part of the Sacred Weed series that aired on the UK's Channel 4 in 1998, Sherritt and his colleagues, an Egyptologist, an ethnobotanist, and a pharmacologist, enlisted two courageous volunteers to drink some wine-soaked flower concoction in the first televised recreation of the ancient sacrament. After a nice fit of the giggles, the restless duo is seen frolicking through the rainy gardens of Hammerwood Park in East Sussex. Though no visions of Osiris were recorded, the blue water lily was shown to have undeniable mind-altering effects, even at relatively low dosage. The whole trippy experiment makes for excellent YouTube viewing. As we move closer to Christianity's home turf, the plot thickens. Some of the best evidence for ancient spiked wine just happens to come from modern-day Galilee, where the magical appeal of the drink that would later show up in the wedding at Cana and Christianity's founding event, the Last Supper, extended far beyond its alcohol content. The homeland of Jesus was praised in antiquity for its wine production, going all the way back to the Canaanites. In 2013, murky hearsay met hard fact when the Tel Kabri site, an hour north of Nazareth, made international headlines. 40 jars of herbal wine were unearthed in what became known as, quote, the world's oldest wine cellar, dating to about 1700 BC. Organic residue from each of the jars was subjected to thorough testing at the Brandeis University Department of Chemistry. The results of the GCMS analyses showed remarkable consistency across the entire batch, indicating, quote, a sophisticated understanding of the botanical landscape and the pharmacopoeic skills necessary to produce a complex beverage that balanced preservation, palatability, and psychoactivity. In their peer-reviewed paper, published in the open-source journal PLOS ONE in August 2014, the interdisciplinary team identified a number of organic compounds in the wine. Andrew Coe, senior research fellow at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Center for Materials Research in Archaeology and Ethnology, Asaf Yasser Landau, professor of archaeology at the University of Haifa, and Eric Klein, professor of classics, anthropology, and history at George Washington University, noted the challenge in trying to pair these freshly captured biomarkers with their ancient organic sources. Like McGovern, they acknowledge that the compounds are present at varying concentrations in many different plants and herbs. Nevertheless, they can still piece together an accurate match based on the natural distribution of ancient commodities and surviving documentary accounts from ancient Galilee and the surrounding area. Aside from the Greek, many ancient Near Eastern languages like Egyptian, Sumerian, Akkadian, Elamite, Hittite, Hebrew, and Aramaic have preserved the names of a dizzying number of plants, herbs, and fungi. By some estimates, however, only 20% of those species referenced in the dusty texts have been definitively identified by genus. That's why, for example, the debate over the kind of laurel employed by the Pythian priestesses at Delphi can rage on, because the ancient plant may not quite correspond to our modern scientific classification of the Laurus genus, let alone the Laurus nobilis species. But the written ethnobotanical evidence, such as the wine formulas of Dioscorides, are only half the puzzle. Completing it demands the rigorous collection of organic residue from ancient vessels, which can then be paired with paleoecological maps that plot where each of the analyzed species actually grew in antiquity. While this interdisciplinary effort was not part of the archaeological mindset until quite recently, the combination of ancient texts, chemical data, and habitat maps is finally shedding much-needed light on the art and science of ancient winemaking. And the results from places like Tel Kabri show exactly where the Greeks inherited their taste for infused, mind-altering wine. In addition to tartaric acid, the GCMS readings at Tel Kabri included cinnamic acid, oleanolic acid, cineol, caryophyllene, and methyl syringate. According to the team, the most likely candidates that would have spiked the palatial red wine at Tel Kabri include honey, storax resin, liquidambar orientalis, terebinth resin, pistachia palestina, or terebinthus, cypress roots, Cyperus rotundus, cedar oil, Cedrus libani, juniper berries, Juniperus communis or phoenicia, mint, mentha, myrtle, Myrtus communis, and cinnamon bark, cinnamomum. The many ingredients of this luxurious ancient concoction are attested as wine additives in the so-called Mari letters, a collection of Mesopotamian tablets written in Akkadian in the 18th century BC. Evidence of a similar herbal kick appears in the widely published Egyptian recipes for kefi, temple incense, that began circulating in the 15th century BC. Nothing like the blue water lily was identified in the regal cellar, but the adjoining banquet hall hints at the religious nature of this special brew, as does the Juniperus genus, certain species of which are revered for their psychoactivity. Juniper berries contain rich, volatile oils with antiviral, antibiotic, and antifungal properties, which may explain their superstitious use for protection in traditional rites and ceremonies. Historically, shamans in Central Asia have resorted to juniper for ritual, magical, and medicinal purposes, making it likely one of the oldest fumigants of humankind. The Hunza people of the Hindu Kush in northern Pakistan, for example, say juniper is directly responsible for the supernatural powers of their bitayos, the magicians, healers, and prophets. They manifest their abilities only after inhaling the smoke of burning juniper branches and drinking warm goat's blood. After this, they dance to rhythmic drumbeats until they had attained the trance state. When asked about the future, they passed on the messages of the fairies in the form of songs. For the Canaanites, the wine additives identified at Tel Kabri could have come in handy during their far-reaching but understudied marzeia ritual, a drunken funerary feast or memorial banquet for the dead that could last up to a week. The marzeia was reserved exclusively for the upper class of Near Eastern society. As a kind of guild or drinking club, it has earned comparisons to the more well-known wine banquet in ancient Greece, the Symposium. McGovern says music, dance, and the recital of Canaanite myths accompanied the merriment, along with bouts of sexual intercourse to match any Roman bacchanal. But the main purpose of the marzeia, as with the skull cults and graveyard beers, we tracked over 10,000 years from Stone Age Israel and Turkey to ancient Greece and classical Iberia, was to acquaint its participants with the afterlife, and quote, to secure their beatification after death. Particularly fascinating about the marzeia is the possibility that it acted as the bridge between the more archaic drinking ceremonies from Egypt and the Near East, including Tel Kabri, and the later mysteries belonging to both Dionysus and Jesus. Common to all these rituals is the concept of ingesting a special potion for a singular purpose: to transcend ordinary time and space, reaching a state of consciousness where the ancestors still live and breathe, and the gods and goddesses are made real. For lack of vocabulary, scholars often refer to this place as the underworld. And maybe the initiates of the marzeia truly believe they went somewhere, just like the initiates of the Greek and Christian mysteries in the centuries that followed. But at the end of the day, we're only trying to get hold of the mechanism that created the sensation of otherworldly travel and the conviction that creates whole religions in the wake of these unforgettable mystical experiences. The data from Mas Castellar de Pontos show that ordinary beer could hardly take credit for the survival of a graveyard tradition that likely reaches far back into the Stone Age. For the marzeia, ordinary wine doesn't seem to be responsible for its long history either. Clues to the bizarre Canaanite ritual were embedded in one of the cuneiform tablets of Ugarit, modern-day Syria, composed just a few centuries after the royalty at Tel Kabri hatched their psychoactive wine. Despite many failed attempts to decipher the ceremony of the dead, a leading scholar of Canaanite religion and mysticism may have finally figured it out. In The Marzeia and the Ugaritic Magical Ritual System, published in 2015, Gregorio del Omo Lete deconstructs the text known as the Divine Feast of El, referring to the chief Near Eastern deity of this period. For del Omo Lete, professor emeritus at the University of Barcelona, the literal translation of marzeia is descent, implying a journey to the underworld. Alternatively, it could mean, quote, a tool that makes one fall or collapse in ecstasy, or simply lie down dead. In a reading that parallels the Indo-European graveyard beers, del Omo Lete sees evidence for hallucinogenic wine as advanced religious biotechnology, calling the Divine Feast of El a, quote, handbook or recipe for intoxication praxis that induces a, quote, cataleptic state of trance. In this altered state of consciousness reached by drunkenness, the initiate is permitted terrifying entry into the mysterious other world of, quote, infernal ghosts, where a skilled explorer can secure divinatory answers to life's existential questions from the godlike spirits. Or maybe it's the fairies talking. To awaken from this near-death experience, the Ugaritic text orders the paralyzed body of the initiate to be anointed from forehead to navel with an unidentifiable wild plant. Every government warning label on every bottle of Pinot in the United States cautions against a series of risks: birth defects, car accidents, machinery disaster. Not a single one mentions the possibility of dead relatives showing up at the door. Like the written wine formulas of Dioscorides, nothing about the marzeia's special brew even remotely resembles anything we would call wine. McGovern's, quote, extreme beverage culture of the Eastern Mediterranean had crafted an extreme drinking ritual to accompany their extreme drink, perhaps providing the optimal setting to showcase their sophisticated understanding of the botanical landscape and pharmacopoeic skills. The active ingredients that may have potentiated the mixture remain an absolute mystery. But given the hard archaeochemical data of the herbal blends from Egyptian Abydos and Canaanite Telkabri, it's a safe bet that someone like Andrew Coe at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology may crack the Marzea code in the years to come. At 44 years old, Coe is part of the younger generation that benefited from the work of McGovern and other pioneers, such as Richard Evershed at the University of Bristol. But unlike most of his colleagues in the still maturing discipline of archaeological chemistry, Coe has an additional background in classics. It gives him a unique transdisciplinary perspective on the search for ancient beverages. Because of his familiarity with the tradition of drugged wine from Homer to Dioscorides and beyond, Coe is rather open-minded about the possibility of the Marzea linking the Galilee of the Canaanites in 1700 BC to the Galilee of the ancient Greeks and Christians in the 1st century AD. As a sanity check after my trip to Paris, I called his office in Boston to make sure Ruck's scholarship on psychedelic wine was actually supported by the latest evidence. Coe told me about the recent discovery of yet more luxury liquids at another site in Upper Galilee, soon to be published in the Bulletin of the American Schools of Oriental Research. His organic residue analysis of small vessels from a Hellenistic administrative building in Tel Kadesh on the border with Lebanon revealed oil from the iconic Phoenician cedar, Cedrus Lubani, was spiked with the same imported storax resin, Liquidambar orientalis, from the same region of Rhodes that was found 1,500 years earlier in the Canaanite wine of Tel Kabri. Dating to the 2nd century BC, it shows the continuity of psychotropic infusions in the region, well into the period when Greek influence was at its height. So, even if he hasn't found it yet, the odds of Coe eventually securing the hard evidence for overtly psychedelic wine seem good. The chemical answer to the Marzea mystery is within reach. "I think you're absolutely right," Coe said into the phone. "When we're talking about ancient wine, we tend to have a one-size-fits-all approach. But think about beer these days, for example. It's not just for drinking and watching football. We have some really complex beers with different alcohol and flavor profiles. Ancient wine was no different. If you look carefully at the historical record, there was wine for very casual settings, all the way to very formal events, like the mysteries. But like everything else in life, it's probably not so binary. Maybe it's our puritanical background, but we want to separate the two, the casual, mundane drinking from the sacred, religious drinking. Back then, however, the lines were more blurred and things more intertwined. Like at Tel Kabri or Tel Kadesh, I asked, and maybe even the earliest Christian communities who could have been influenced by the Marzea or Dionysian mysteries that we know were active in Galilee at the time of Jesus? Right. At first glance, the wine cellar at Kabri seems like wealthy elites getting hammered and having a good time. But then you look more closely, and I think that's too simplistic of an answer. Because they're adding things to the wine, and those ingredients are not just for preservation. It's not solely to get a buzz from the alcohol. When you look at the literature of the time, there are festivals in Egypt and the Levant, like the Marzea, that are just rife with ritualistic meaning. They are literally communing with the gods and so forth. So I think Kabri does connect to the later Hellenistic and Roman periods, where the mystery or cultic aspect only intensifies. I think what we in the archaeological community have been missing for a while now is that wine is such a perfect beverage, once the right ingredients are added to it, to have a profound religious experience with a psychotropic effect. So I call that kind of wine a potion, because it's not just a drink. It's a sacrament. Coe is confident that the smoking gun evidence for psychedelic wine is out there in the birthplace of Christianity, patiently waiting just underfoot. For many centuries, right up until the wedding at Cana and the Last Supper, the Marzea documented in the Divine Feast of El remained a staple across the region, uniting ancient Israel, Judah, and Babylon in El's wine god cult. Like the Egyptians, Canaanites, and Phoenicians before them, the Israelites and their neighbors were just as interested in the cult of the dead and its special wine that put the Holy Land on the map in the first place. The pagan ritual is actually mentioned twice in the Old Testament, disparagingly, of course, confirming the survival of this rather primordial tradition into biblical times. Despite the Jewish high priest's opposition to the wine-fueled seance, pilgrim flasks, wine decanters, and amphoras have been unearthed from the ancient tombs in and around Jerusalem. And farther south, more death cult remains have come to the surface. In September 2009, a sandstone block accidentally turned up in Wadi Musa, near the Dionysian Temple in Petra. Its partly legible inscription confirms that the hallucinatory Marzea ritual was still alive and well during Jesus' lifetime. The text is clearly dated to the reign of the high-profile Nabataean king Aretas IV Philopatris, 9 BC to AD 40. His daughter, Phasaelis, married King Herod Antipas, the infamous ruler of Galilee. To please his second wife after divorcing Phasaelis, Herod famously served the head of John the Baptist on a platter. Where the Marzea ends and the Dionysian banquet begins, nobody really knows. The god of ecstasy had slowly taken root in the ancient cultural internet of North Africa and the Levant that Osiris and El had been seeding with their magic for millennia. Eventually, part of the wine god would head west to Greece as Dionysus, debuting on Euripides' stage in the 5th century BC with his Asian Maenads after a tour through Anatolia. Over in Athens, Dionysus would become the lord of death like his Egyptian and Near Eastern counterparts, leading an annual train of ghosts into the city during the springtime Anthesteria festival. Similar to our Halloween, it was the time of year when, attracted by the smell of the wine that rose from the opened pithoi, or earthen pots, and spread throughout the city, the souls emerged from the underworld. But another part of the wine god would simply stay put, right where it all began over 3,000 years before Jesus, who would become the latest god of ecstasy to overcome death. The Nazarene was well acquainted with the underworld from the Harrowing of Hell episode that supposedly took place in the 3 days between Jesus' death and resurrection, when the gospel was proclaimed to those who are now dead. It's a neat line of succession: Osiris, to El, to Dionysus, to Jesus. The critical thing that unites them all is extraordinary wine that blurs the boundary between life and death. Immortality potions. But there's a major difference between Dionysus and Jesus on the one hand, and their divine predecessors on the other. A political disagreement. Did this wine belong to the 1% or the 99%? Was it meant for the pharaohs, royalty, and elite? Or was it meant for everybody? Who should have access to the nectar of the gods? Religious revolution was afoot in pre-Christian Galilee. The intoxicant had begun leaking from the Near Eastern palaces and mansions the same way the Kukion had slipped from Eleusis, traveling to wealthy homes across Athens during the scandalous imitation of the sacred rites known as the profanation of the mysteries. As A.D. Nock insightfully remarked in the last chapter, the spiritually curious were being drawn to a kind of private, spontaneous pagan piety, where elements of choice, movement, and individual enthusiasm were preferable to whatever soul-crushing boredom the local temples had to offer the pagan and Jewish residents of the area. By the time of Jesus, a democratizing trend led by ecstatic women had revamped sacred wine into what Euripides, 4 centuries earlier, had called a sacrament for, quote, simple folk, or phaloteron, quote, equally to the rich and to the lowly has Dionysus given the painless joy of wine. So forget the Egyptian pharaohs. Forget the royal families at Tel Kabri, Petra, and everywhere in between. Forget the Marzea, reserved only for the vineyard-owning aristocrats, with nothing but time and money to waste on their spooky, sometimes decadent ritual. Forget the Jewish high priests, who banned the Marzea, with all its occult implications. And forget the buzzkill Pharisees, who later in the Gospels would call Jesus a drunk, or oinopotes. People were aching for their own little taste of that miraculous wine, and for the already smashed wedding guests at Cana, where the only way for the Jesus of John's Gospel to prove his divinity was to perform the signature miracle of Dionysus. That's exactly what they got. 180 gallons worth. By bringing the oldest trick in the Dionysian book back home to the Near East, where the sacrament itself was born in the distant past, and where the god of ecstasy had reestablished a foothold, thanks to the regional acceptance of Greek culture, the Gospel of John was issuing a stark challenge to the 1% of the first century AD. From the beginning, the Christian potion was destined for mass consumption, just like the Dionysian potion that had been working its magic in Greece and Greek-speaking hubs of the Eastern Mediterranean for centuries, including parts of Galilee. Unlike the ritual beverages that preceded it, the wine at Cana was meant to travel all over the ancient world, into the hands of humble people with humble hopes for the afterlife, and into humble parts of the Roman Empire still farther west of Greece, where the wine god that Jesus would soon replace was in desperate need of a revival, all thanks to the politicians in Rome. As I exit the Salle des Etats, I take one last look at the Mona Lisa's patronizing smirk. All night long, when she is blanketed in moonlight, Da Vinci's masterpiece is stuck here staring at a complete and total fantasy. Not through any fault of Veronese. The wedding feast at Cana is a fair interpretation of John's Gospel, but the scene almost certainly never happened. Why is the raucous episode from ancient Galilee recorded in John and nowhere else? And why the shameless infringement of the Dionysian epiphanies from Elis and Andros? Scholars like Dennis MacDonald have concluded that John cast Jesus in the same mold as the god of ecstasy to emphasize his godhood. Fair enough. John gets 0 points for originality. But a god without wine in the Southern Levant was like a car without wheels, so perhaps John had little choice but to incorporate the extreme beverage into that particular epiphany around AD 30. Nevertheless, the question remains, what's the real relationship between Jesus and Dionysus? And what's the real message here? For those Greek speakers who could recognize the secret symbols and language, as A.D. Nock put it, John had many more surprises in store. Cana was just the opening act, a sneak peek of the real dinner, 3 years later, that would forever alter the course of human history, putting Jesus at the top of our species' virtual Twitter feed with 2.42 billion followers. The biggest religion on the planet today. The biggest religion ever. It all started at the Last Supper, a more intimate affair among friends, where the wine became blood and Jesus introduced part two of the trademark Dionysian sacrament, the raw flesh. In John's poetic treatment of the event, the sacred combination of bread and wine, flesh and blood, represents the most advanced biotechnology in all of antiquity, what St. Ignatius would later call the pharmakon athanasias, the drug of immortality that guaranteed instant divinity and life everlasting. To the Greeks, this magical procedure was known as apotheosis, or deification. Anyone who ate and drank the god became the god. Once the exclusive property of Egyptian pharaohs and Near Eastern elite, the sacrament had been dribbling over the mountains and forests of the Mediterranean ever since Euripides. But civilizations rise and fall, and the mysteries have a way of getting caught in the crossfire. Once obsessed with the wine god whom they inherited from their predecessors, especially in that Greek-speaking part of southern Italy known as Magna Graecia, a moral panic had swept through the Roman Empire when men started joining in the debauched festivals previously restricted to women. The Roman Senate prohibited the full-blown bacchanalia in 186 BC, creating an uncertain future for the god of ecstasy. Around 20 BC, the conservative historian Livy wrote his dramatic retelling of the scandal, portraying it as a reaction against the sudden infiltration of too many Greek elements into Roman worship. The final straw for the Roman Senate was the Italian witch, Pacula Annia, the scandalous high priestess of Bacchus in Campania, the heartland of Magna Graecia, home to Naples and Pompeii. In the years leading up to the mass crackdown on the Dionysian Mysteries in 186 BC, Pakula Ania refused to initiate any men over the age of 20. Rather than having women in the control of men, says Dr. Fiacre Mac Gorain, a classicist at University College London, this cult is putting young, impressionable men under the control of women. In a staunchly patriarchal society like Rome, that was an act of war. So the authorities made the flood of magical wine slow to a trickle. By the time of Jesus, the world was ready for another injection of holy madness. At long last, the faithful may have cheered, the Son of God had come home to Galilee. Call him Jesus if you like. But when John's Gospel called him the only begotten or unique offspring of God, residing in the lap of the Father, his audience knew what he meant. After all, where else but Nazareth would Jesus grow up? Only minutes from Dionysian country in Scythopolis, and just down the road from the Mona Lisa of Galilee in Sepphoris. Of all the places for Jesus to call home, the drug-riddled Napa Valley of the ancient world just happened to be the one. Where wine was a sacrament for the cult of the dead that found inspiration in both the long-running Marseilla and the Dionysian Mysteries, and where the magician from Nazareth and his earliest followers could have sourced an endless supply of those mind-altering substances the Southern Levant had been pumping into the area for three millennia, the same drugs that would soon be encyclopedically catalogued in the most consulted, most durable manuscript of the next 2,000 years, the Materia Medica. Less than a decade after Jesus' death, Dioscorides was born in Cilicia in Asia Minor, near the modern Turkish-Syrian border. He studied in nearby Tarsus, the birthplace of Paul, who, before becoming St. Paul, was simply Saul of Tarsus. The plants, herbs, and fungi documented by the father of drugs on his extensive travels with the Roman army under Emperor Nero are overwhelmingly concentrated on the Greek-speaking world of the Aegean and the Levant. It was the epicenter of experimental wine mixing, where a heavy pagan population squeezed every drop of psychoactive potential from its ancient cash crop, and where the new Dionysus had miraculously returned for one final mission. Even if they didn't feel it on the eastern frontier of the Roman Empire, the would-be Christians knew the Dionysian Mysteries had faced an existential crisis in Italy, where as many as 6,000 followers of the god of ecstasy were executed in one fell swoop during the Roman Senate's bloody campaign in 186 BC. There was no predicting the next moral panic. The most powerful empire in the world, an all-male enterprise, was clamping down on a female-led religion that promised immortality to its initiates. With only a few ounces of its secret potion, this religion with no name had finally broken the spiritual exclusivity of Egypt and the Near East and the monopoly of the Greek families in Eleusis. And for largely political reasons, the Romans wanted this dangerous religion, what Euripides once called an immoral trick aimed at women, to simply go away. But the Dionysian Mysteries couldn't just disappear. Everyone deserved a taste of divinity. So perhaps the only way to keep the magical wine alive was to fill the ancient world with more Pakula Anias than the Roman Empire could ever possibly control. But the wilderness wasn't the safest or most convenient place to win new converts to the Greek death cult. The god of ecstasy had to come indoors. And Christianity had the answer. On the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, everything was up for grabs in the first century AD, when the latest Son of God, born of a virgin, stepped into the spotlight. In the Gospel of John, the wedding at Cana may have set the drug of immortality loose on the streets of Galilee, but it was the Last Supper that brought the Christian Eucharist into people's homes. Even Dionysus himself never managed to pull that off. Aside from the public festivals and the few Athenians who blasphemed Eleusis during the profanation of the mysteries, Dionysus' churches were kept off the grid, in the open air of the Greek countryside. So far as John's audience was concerned, this new Dionysus had just upstaged the old Dionysus, and their interpretation of John's gospel would have been very different from today's. The Jesus they would have seen was a Jesus who didn't come to start a new religion, but a Jesus who came to save the fragile mysteries with an epic, encore performance. A Jesus who came to open source the magical wine for the masses and to finish the populist movement he started in Greece when his name was Dionysus. It is impossible to understand the roots of Christianity without understanding the world in which it appeared. For roughly the first 300 years of its existence, Christianity was an illegal cult, just like the cult of Dionysus. By appealing to poor folks, and especially women, Jesus was simply picking up where the Dionysian mysteries left off. Politically, he posed the same threat to the Roman establishment as Dionysus. Anything that directed attention and loyalty away from the public cult of the emperor and the traditional Roman gods was considered dangerous. Because at the time, separating young, eligible men from their military service and busy mothers from their family obligations upset the chain of command. Neither belonged in the wilderness, getting high with the god of drugs. And they didn't belong at the wedding party where Jesus unveiled Dionysus' signature miracle either. John makes the general paranoia pretty explicit when he records the reaction of the Jewish high priests to Jesus' string of magic acts following Cana. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But the politics and legality were only part of the concern. At stake was the entire social order. Jesus and Dionysus were two peas in a pod. They both stood for the revolutionary principle that everybody deserved the nectar of the gods, regardless of class. While the Greeks and southern Italians had many centuries to manage the uncomfortable balancing act between the 1% and the 99%, Jesus' open invitation to an immortality potion like the Eucharist would have shocked the wealthy pagans of Galilee, as well as the influential Jewish families of Jerusalem. Magical wine was supposed to be their prerogative, just the way it had been for thousands of years. Salvation didn't belong in the hands of the commoners. After his success in classical Athens, Dionysus was the first monopoly buster in the Near East. For an extra kick in the pants, Jesus showed up a few centuries later with an even more convenient solution for anyone dissatisfied with the old-time religions. A solution the homebrewers at Mas Casillar de Pontos had already discovered. Simply invite some friends over and cook the sacrament up at home. In the end, Dionysus and Jesus were both really bad for the status quo. There's a reason the crackdown on the Bacchanalia by the Roman Senate in 186 BC was the first large-scale religious persecution in European history. And there's a reason Christianity followed suit. In the eyes of the ruling class, the idea of continuity between the Greek and Christian mysteries was pretty darn clear. Barbaric to the core, they both offered direct access to the Lord of Death, following the consumption of the god himself in the form of fortified wine. With their exotic sacraments, Dionysians and Christians fit the same vile narrative. According to Mary Beard, John North, and Simon Price, the leading historians of Roman religion, the issue was exacerbated by the appeal of Christianity to women. The combination of stereotypes of foreign and female, which had been deployed by classical Greeks of Eastern women out of control, had always been especially potent. This is the political and spiritual backdrop of the pagan continuity hypothesis, and it can't be dismissed. The same people who were attracted to the radical cult of Dionysus were the same people who were attracted to the cult of Jesus. They were not so different from the spiritual but not religious of today. Seekers on the hunt for transcendence, a real experience with real meaning, where the key to that Dionysian experience was the kind of wine that was universally regarded as a pharmakon. It drove the witches like Pakula Anya and their covens mad. It made them delirious. It provoked visions. And in addition to the religious conservatives in Athens who didn't want their Eleusinian mysteries profaned, it also pissed off the authorities in Rome, the same authorities who would later accuse the Christians of cannibalism and throw them to the lions. The immortality potion is what unites the ancient Greeks of the final centuries BC with the Paleo-Christians of the early centuries AD. As we will see in detail in the next chapter, the more the Gospel of John could convince potential recruits that the Christian Eucharist was indeed the same pharmakon, the greater the chances of the young faith's success in a world where the Dionysian sacrament still dominated the ancient Mediterranean, where, with every drink from the sacred cup, the Maenads risked being branded as criminals. The early Christians ran the same risk, of course. But for some, the price of religious liberty has always been worth the cost. The way the Greek and Christian mysteries were targeted by the Roman Empire is well documented in the historical record. Largely ignored by modern scholars, however, is the degree to which the common sacrament of wine motivated the harsh suppression of these revolutionary movements, and whether the great secret of Dionysus and Jesus alike, the secret that unlocked the key to immortality, was in fact drugged wine. It's been a long afternoon, and the Louvre is about to close. I just need a few minutes of peace and quiet to wrap my mind around everything I've seen today. I know exactly where to go to escape the tourists. I make a beeline for the Winged Victory of Samothrace and descend the grand staircase to the museum's Greek collection on the lower level of the Sully Wing. I sneak past the crowd admiring the armless Venus de Milo and duck into my oasis, the Salle de Caryatidae. Intentionally or not, the Louvre has constructed a pretty incredible tribute to the god of ecstasy. Most of the marble to be found in room 348 is Roman, based on Greek originals. Like the Italian head of Dionysus from the 2nd century AD, with those luxurious locks twisting their way down the god's neck and shoulders. If you ever wondered why Jesus was the only Jewish man of 1st century Galilee to get the Jim Morrison look, this is why. Across the hall, the woodland god Pan, straight out of Narnia, is clutching a bunch of grapes. After leading choirs of nymphs through the hills of Greece, the wine god's confidant would always take a midday nap. Whenever startled by a passing shepherd, Pan would wake with a terrifying shout, giving us the word panic. The goat man was the illiterate peasantry's last refuge against an encroaching Christianity. As a result, our popular image of Satan likely comes from this horned, lustful deity, the rustic one, Paganus in Latin, whence the word pagan. I circle the Borghese vase. Standing 5.5 feet tall, it boasts an incredible parade of bacchants carved into the marble. Dazed and confused, one has just lost consciousness. Slumped over in ecstasy, a shaggy-tailed satyr carries him along with thyrsos in hand, the long, hollow wand used to carry the wine god's plant additives, according to Ruck. From the celebrant's grasp has just slipped the cantharos that knocked him out. I wonder what was in it. The museum's didactic label says this piece, quote, is widely admired for the fine craftsmanship of the figures shown in a trance typical of Dionysian processions. The English plaque calls Dionysus the god of wine and revelry. In French, he's the god of wine and intoxication, dieu du vin et de l'ivresse. The language barriers never stop. But the meaning is clear. Behind the Dionysian mysteries was no ordinary wine, and the Borghese vase is one of the best representations of the madness that overtook the initiates of this religion. Madness that did not come from wine as we know it, but an infused potion spiked with any number of drugs. What G408 and G409 tried to communicate, and what Dioscorides later recorded with his wine formulas, is now a scientific fact. The latest archaeochemical data from the Near East shows that herbs, resins, and other plant additives were mixed into wine for at least 3,000 years before the birth of Christianity to increase its psychoactive profile. Why would that time-honored tradition suddenly stop at Jesus? As I navigate the Salle de Caryatidae, I see a bench, but not just any bench, a private retreat, nestled snugly in a secluded alcove. I plop into place, close my eyes, and cast a steady exhale into the Dionysian sanctuary. I open my eyes to a crucifixion scene. A poor figure hanging from a pine tree, about to be put to death. It's not the wine god from Nazareth. This is the Silenus Marcius, another close companion of Dionysus. The 8-foot Marcius Supplicié, sometimes called the Torment of Marcius or Hanging Marcius, was originally cut around 200 BC. It memorializes the legend of the cocky satyr who challenged the god Apollo to a flute contest and lost. His punishment was to be flayed alive. Plato tells us Marcius's shaggy hide was later made into a wineskin. Philostratus goes a step further and says the satyr sentenced himself to death for playing out of tune. Marcius looks forward to the slaughter so he can be reborn as a container for Dionysus' potion, our liquid salvation. Dying so that we may live, this self-sacrifice on the tree for the good of humanity occurs centuries before Jesus died on the cross. If the naked Marcius were given a loincloth and hung in a church, I wonder how long it would take the faithful to realize it wasn't Jesus. Right here for all to see, a statue like this brings the pagan continuity hypothesis into full focus. But how far can we take it? John's gospel certainly pulled the god of ecstasy into Christianity. Did the sex, drugs, and rock and roll really come along for the ride? Father Francis is an open-minded guy, but how do I even start down this road? Looking at 2,500-year-old Greek pottery is one thing. Suggesting the religion to which the priest has dedicated his life was chiseled from Greek stone and ripped from the pages of the Bacchae is another thing altogether. Such things are best discussed over drinks. Chapter 11. Drunk with the Nectar of Eternity. Just as surprisingly warm as yesterday, the sun is setting on a gorgeous Saturday in Paris. I bounce down from my Airbnb on the Ile de la Cité and cross the Pont d'Arcole into a cobweb of streets in the 4th arrondissement. I'm heading for the watering hole that sprang to mind from my final moments in the Louvre, as I sat across from Marcias, gazing at the marble statue of Apollo the Lizard Slayer. After a brisk walk, I arrive at the bustling bar to claim the only remaining mini-table in the eye of the storm. Metallic reptiles scurry across the brickwork and mutate into tiled mosaics on the bathroom walls, assuring me I've landed in the lizard lounge. In the din of clanking glasses and drunken French conversation, I rummage through my stack of notes in preparation for the next face-off. A few minutes later, my Roman Catholic friend joins me. Still no collar. First things first, we order a blue cheese and mushroom burger and two sorely needed Scottish brown ales. Father Francis fills me in on the day's mind and life meetings. I show him some of my photos from the Salle de Cariatide. By the time the food arrives, I've tried my best to convince the mild-mannered cleric that my investigation is no less heretical than his own. The Renaissance man across from me in the purple-colored shirt, peeking out from a charcoal sweater, is already entertained. But I can't tell if he's laughing at me or with me. The theme of tonight's dinner is apotheosis. What does it mean to become God? If Father Francis has no problem with lesser mortals like ourselves bursting into kaleidoscopic rainbows after decades of intense meditation, then why not simply drink the sacred potion and cut to the chase? At the end of the day, aren't we both talking about that cryptic promise from Eleusis? Overcoming the limitations of the physical body and cheating death? That moment of intense rapture sought by the Maenads of Dionysus until they became identified with the god himself? And aren't he and Ruck both committing the same arch-heresy by suggesting that the original, obscured truth of Christianity has nothing to do with worshiping Jesus and everything to do with becoming Jesus? Aren't we all just gods and goddesses in the making? Maybe the concept of apotheosis doesn't sound particularly heretical today, but a few hundred years ago, it got the likes of Giovanni Pico della Mirandola into a load of trouble. In 1484, the upstart Italian was only 21 years old when he met Lorenzo de' Medici, who promptly invited him into the Florentine Academy that was about to punch the Renaissance into high gear. Already a student of Greek, as well as Latin, Hebrew, and Arabic, the newest Florentine got to work writing Oratio de Hominis Dignitate, Oration on the Dignity of Man, the so-called Manifesto of the Renaissance. He wanted to publicly debut the Oratio, together with his 900 theses, in Rome on the Epiphany of 1487, the God's Gift Day. But Pope Innocent VIII was not impressed. He put a halt to the spectacle and condemned every one of Pico della Mirandola's theses as renovating the errors of pagan philosophers. All for the young man's simple but revolutionary act of applauding the infinite goodness and unlimited potential of every man, woman, and child on this planet. Under the principle of ad fontes, back to the source, the humanists were just beginning to tap the wisdom of the founders of Western civilization in their original language. Whenever you do that, a nagging question inevitably surfaces. If the Greeks didn't need Jesus to find salvation, why do we?